Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to this podcast, Season 8, Episode 5. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Jonathan Kuhlein in Florenceville, Bristol, New Brunswick.
Hello there, kids.
And we have appearing live from the Transporter Buffer, Jaime Lopez Jr.
How's it going?
Who's actually back, been reassembled back in Seattle, I guess, right?
The beauty is, you know, it's just the future now. You know, you get to skip stuff. It's like taking a nap and you're like, hey, the day's gone by.
Nice. Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right. So we have another big pack of fact check for you folks. So a little birdie told me that they are in fact discussing building a TOS spinoff somewhere in Mississauga, which is where I think Jonathan's told us before that Strange New World is filmed in Mississauga, because there's an Enterprise set there, so it makes sense, right? And I got here in brackets in case they crash the saucer section, but
they don't have a counselor on this version of the ship.
Well, but that's what they did in the movie, right? They actually trashed the set, right? So. And Starfleet Academy, I don't know why I thought that Stranger Worlds was filmed south of me, but I think you had mentioned it before. It's in Mississauga, right, John?
Yeah, Stranger Worlds is in Mississauga, but Discovery was down just south of you, and that's where they're also building the Starfleet Academy stuff.
Yeah, so Starfleet Academy is filming at Pinewood Studio in Toronto, which is just south of me in the Portlands, like literally just directly south for me. I saw an interview with Picardo, what's his first
Robert.
Name again? Robert Picardo, talking about how they're actually getting ready to film season 2, so
yep,
they've already done a bit of it. So Strange New Worlds will be filming season 5 in September, and Academy is about to start filming season 2, and this is the source from the Toronto Star. Mm-hmm. Next, Ted Cassidy is the name of the person who played Rock in What Are Little Girls Made Of, you know, in the Roger Corman episode. Corby. So it's not Corman at all. Okay. Standing at 6'9", Ted Cassidy was, you know, he was the original Lurch in the Addams Family. You rang, is what he would say. But he was a voice actor in a ton. He has a really distinctive voice. So as you hear a little bit of it in What Are Little Girls Made Of, but then he starts reproducing other people's voices in the show. But he had this very deep voice, and he would appear in all kinds of things like the Flintstones, Super Friends, Space Ghost, Birdman. And he was actually I think he played a inappropriately cast Indian in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And he was also in McKenna's Gold, which is another sort of big time early, you know, Western that was big time over there, right? So, but according to the stuff I was reading, this is his only broadcast appearance in Star Trek, although his voice is used in the Corberite Maneuver, which I think is one of the, season 1, episode 10. That's the one with Ron Howard's brother.
But wasn't he famously one of the faces they show in the end credits, though? I feel like they showed him over and over again in the end credits.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't, but he only ever appeared as Rock, right?
Yeah.
So in person. So maybe that one. But he was also a voiceover in the arena. Oh, and he's the Gorn.
Oh,
you know, in the arena with Shatner, it's his voice, but he's apparently uncredited. So he did make a blooper reel once where he runs. He was in Lost in Space. So he's wearing his uniform from Lost in Space, and he runs in, picks up William Shatner, and whisks him away. You know. So that's in one of the Star Trek bloopers, but he's only ever been on the show in an episode once, like in person, right? Not so much in voice. He's been in voice 3 times, I guess. So Through the Lens of Time, which is the episode from a couple of weeks ago, and What Are Little Girls Made Of do not take place on the same planet or same world. The original series episode takes place on XO3 and in the search for lost Kirby. Kirby exit? Is it Kirby again? No, I've written it down wrong.
Corby.
Is it Corby? Corby. Sorry, wrong game here. But yeah, so he was in they were looking for the Corby episode. Vadia 9 is the long forgotten homeworld of the Q, apparently, which they didn't talk about. It. Did they mention that in the show? I can't remember. And that's why Trelane notices Chaplin and Corby and follows them to Starbase 1. And that's where the nuptial disruption episode came from, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of a crossover, like a little bit about those two. Because I had said I wanted to look back and see if it was the same planet. And then we were talking about Foundation last week, and I went back and found that interview with Lee Pace on Seth Meyers' show. And he said that in season one, he played Cleon 12, where he was serious, I'm quoting in quotes, he's serious about Emperoring. In season two, he plays Cleon 18, so he was really serious and killed a lot of people. And now in season three, he's playing Cleon 24, and he says he's kind of chilling. So we were talking about trying to figure out. So I mean, if you think about it, if he's 12, then you know, Dawn and Dusk would be like, you know, one number away from that, and then same thing when he's playing 18, then the other one would be 17 and 19 respectively. So there's no overlap between the Cleons. And I had a chat with my friend who also read the books back when he was a teenager, and he said that they didn't have the clone idea, but they did have Cleons. Like he would, like, what's his name? The guy who wakes up every 150 years, he would wake up and he would find
Harry,
Cleon, whatever. Yeah. Harry Seldon. It would be Cleon 18 or it'd be Cleon 24 or whatever. So I don't know if the numbers actually line up with the book, but that's who Lee Pace says he's playing in this series. Right. And he would know because he's looking at the script, right? and he said in the interview, too, he said that the robot is actually in control. I think we've kind of sort of come to that, she's sort of pulling the strings, right? So, and then I've got a link here to, I guess, to the video. I'll put that in the show notes. And I mentioned agoraphobia, which is not commonly thought of as the fear of open spaces, but it's more specifically the fear of being somewhere where you can't, where there's no easy escape, right? So, if you're used to living in a cave like Elijah Bailey and they bring you out to the surface to do a murder investigation, you would feel, you know, panicky because you can't just go back in the elevator anytime you want, kind of thing. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This important bit of nuance, I'll bring up something here. I do not have this one, but I'll use ski lifts, you know, like on the mountain as an example of like it being really clear to me. I do not have a fear of heights, so I can be in airplanes and look out the window, be perfectly fine. I have a fear of falling. And the best example is two different ski lifts. One, which is like the mega big ski lift that I've been on that like it's very well enclosed and it's just like premium, right? It's like way on a way taller mountain, way higher. And it's great. I don't have any problem. What scared the crap out of me was being on the I don't know, like green circle ski lift, right? It's like one step above the bunny trail, bunny hills. And that one was like a lawn chair on a rope in the sky. it felt real rickety. I was like, oh my God, I'm like really scared of this. So not as fear of heights, fear of falling.
Yeah, so I'm allergic to pain too. So, I mean, that's the reason why I'm afraid of heights, right?
So the ultimate test for me, two that come to mind related to Seattle and Toronto. One would be I've not yet been to the reinvigorated Space Needle where it's an all glass enclosure. And then they also have the like step on this, you know, 2 or 3 foot thick glass where you can look straight down. I kind of wonder how I will react to that. I will let you all know and follow up. The other one is I'm pretty sure CN Tower has the like, not bungee jumping, but they like connect you and then let you like sort of like dangle off the side, right?
Yeah, they call it an edge walk. You walk around the edge.
And you lean out. You lean out on over the edge of the precipice. We also have the big chunk of glass, too. And I can tell you for myself, I cannot step on that piece of glass.
See, so I've done, like, zip lines and stuff in the Las Vegas, not the strip, but, like, off-strip area. And so that's been totally fine. So I suspect I will be fine for both of these, but you that's how phobias work. They're non-rational. So I will let you all know if and when I get to try these out.
Cool. All right.
I'm kind of like Jaime. I'm not afraid of falling. I'm afraid of the landing after falling. So that's it's a different thing.
Same thing with me. Same thing with me. Yeah. I think what it is for me is the, like, I was up on the roof of the house the other day and I had to step onto a large, tall ladder, and you sort of have to very carefully transfer your weight from one to the other. And there's that momentary, oh my God, all hell's going to break loose feeling that you get. I think that's what bothers me the most, right? Is knowing that there's potential that I could fall, or the ladder could slide or whatever, right? Mm. All those kind of things. Although I probably would just break a leg, I jumped off a fence once and broke an arm, but that didn't help.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things, right? So James J.Y. Young was the founding member of Styx that I couldn't remember the name of. He was actually born in Chicago, which is where the band is from. And just for OG Tommy Shaw, who's also was an early member of Styx, but not a founding member, he's actually from Alabama. Terry Gowan is the name of Larry Gowan's son, who plays bass in Styx. And Larry Gowan joined Styx in 1999 while Dennis DeYoung was ill. And then eventually they had a falling out, blah, 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 blah. Huh. All right. Oh, and then, so this is a little bit of follow-up, and this is a correction for Jonathan. Neil Percival Young, Order of Canada and Order of Manitoba, was born November 12, 1945, in Toronto. He's a Canadian-American. He is the son of journalist, sports writer, and novelist Scott Young. Young moved the family to Amimi, later to Toronto, and then he went with his mother to Winnipeg. Huh. And the Scott Young Public School is named in honor of the writer, not principal.
There you go. Now I know.
Yeah. So, and actually, it's funny because I went and saw Neil Young twice this weekend. I got to go. I went with the ticket that I bought on Sunday, and then I went again on Tuesday. Got totally soaked in the rain and all that kind of stuff. But it was still really good. But Astrid Young was the opener at 7 p.m. Which I didn't go. I didn't go to the second night, but I saw part of her show at the beginning. I didn't make the connection. That is actually Neil Young's stepsister.
Hmm.
They share the same father, even though, you know, Neil Young's parents were divorced, and that's why he ended up in Manitoba, because that's where his mother was from. But yeah, so born in Toronto, lived in Omimi, you know, Winnipeg, and now I guess he lives in L.A. somewhere or something like that. Oh, and just a couple other things. So I think it's really cool. So he had this sort of, had all these earth-friendly exhibitors there, like power, you know, and, clean power and that kind of stuff. He didn't allow them to sell Budweiser beer at the venue, even though it's called the Budweiser Stage. He had it renamed to the Freshwater Amphitheater for the night. And so they didn't have any Budweiser products. They only sold Mill Street beer, which is all organic, and cans of water, not bottles of water.
Yeah. Yeah, good on the cans one. I know that Jason Momoa is big on that as well. Like, just, you know, turn in the cans, melt it down, form a new can, and you don't really have to mine it anymore. You don't have to deal with the plastic living forever sort of thing.
Yeah, and then, and in California, a lot of times they have those reusable bottles too. I think it was some show somewhere where they had, it's like a metal cap, and you can reuse it as a water bottle, right? Which is kind of cool. Yeah, and the other thing too is Carol was saying that he had said he wasn't going to tour anymore unless he could find a green way to go from show to show. Like, he didn't want to be jumping in airplanes and stuff like that, right? So I assume he's trucking.
You got to do like John Madden, but updated. So John Madden, the former football coach and then longtime NFL announcer, would famously not get on airplanes, I believe, due to a fear of either airplanes or heights. And so he was always on a bus. He had his own custom bus setup or motor coach or RV kind of thing. So the green version, I assume, in the modern era is an electric one, right? I don't know if such a thing exists, but it seems
to be. Yeah, Rivian trucks and stuff, and there's electric, there are electric buses, and there's electric transport trailers, right?
But, like, not ones that are connected to, like, power cables, like, just self-propelled.
Yeah, like with big giant batteries in them, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, like, it's like Ewan McGregor, when they did the Long Way Up, he and Charlie drove electric bikes that Harley made specially for them, but the crew that traveled with him drove in Rivian trucks, and they actually drove in the first and second trucks off the assembly line.
Hmm.
Yeah, and they one episode they did it. Let's see how far this can go. Like, once we hit E on it, how far will it go? And they found out, and they were in the middle of nowhere with no power, right? So, but apparently you can tow a Rivian and it'll charge, right?
Oh, just because the recycling of the tires. That's funny.
Yeah. It'll regenerate electricity. Yeah, but yeah, they were surprised, and that was a big challenge. And Rivian apparently, because to get sort of the marketing and the name out there, they set up charging stations all the way from, I think it's Tierra del Fuego is the lowest point in South America, all the way up to L.A. Hmm. So they installed charging stations there. So it was kind of silly for Charlie and Ewan to do that so early in the game, right? But they did it. All right. So that's it for the fact check. Welcome to the fact check show. And
No, this was the handy information part of the show.
Yes, the handy information, the stuff you didn't want to know that you probably should, if you didn't listen to the after show, you had no idea what we're talking about. All right, and we'll move on to the headlines. So this is a keen contribution, and who wants to take this one?
Well, I thought you were going to do this one.
Oh, yeah, I can do this one. Okay, yeah, sure. I'm not sure if he's talking about the... So the headline is Star Trek Lower Decks wins 2 Hugo Awards. The first franchise win since TNG or the Next Generation, and but there were in the article they talked about some other Hugo Awards that were won before that. Discovery was nominated for one episode, a few other of them were nominated, but this is the first win for Lower Decks. And I wasn't sure, is this for an episode or for was
it won?
Did you get the
one for an episode and one for a graphic novel
for a book, right? Yeah, I thought so.
So the episode Fisher Quest won for a one. Was one of the wins. The series finale was nominated, and it was up against Fallout, Agatha All Along, Doctor Who, it says. And yeah, so it won this Hugo Award. And then on top of that, they did this sort of cool, like, choose your own adventure style graphic novel last year called Warp Your Own Way. And that also won for... I don't know, what was the category? What did they say it was called? Best graphic story or comic for the Hugo Award. So yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, you know, I think it's no secret that we all love that show. And yeah, it's nice to see that it's still got some juice, even after its untimely ending.
Well, the Hugo Award's a big deal. Like, yep. It would, you know, that's like people like Asimov used to win that thing, right?
So absolutely.
Cool. Good on him. All right. And then over to you, JPK, for some stuff.
Yeah. So we were talking about the sale of Paramount to Skydance and what this was going to do and some of the potential, you know, after effects of this big deal. Last week, we talked about how Paramount got the rights to all the UFC fights. That was their first big swing. The apparently jumping ship from Netflix, with whom they've been associated the last decade, working on Stranger Things and associated products therein, and they're going to go over to Paramount for a new deal. So that's not nothing. That's a pretty big signing. I mean, everybody's been kind of wondering now that they're wrapping up Stranger Things, what they're going to do next. And although they still haven't said what they're doing, they're going to do it for Paramount. And it's a pretty big turnaround from, you know, even a few weeks ago, people were like, so Paramount's still a thing? And now they're starting to add more talent, more reasons to have this in your menu of streaming services. So a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I think some of these will end up consolidating, you know. I think you all talked about this the last time, the Disney and Hulu kind of smooshing together. I think more notable on the US side, because you all have had it split a little differently, but you know, you can't have everybody long term just dumping and losing money into these. You need a smaller handful of them who can actually survive, I think.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think it makes sense. I'm, you know, obviously, I guess I'm curious, Jaime. So I don't know if you've gotten any emails or anything. Like, I don't know if you still have a Hulu subscription or how your Lopez calculus is working out right now. But if they're going to amalgamate and reduce the cost, or they're going to amalgamate and increase the cost, like how does it all work out in the wash for our American listeners now?
I'm on one of those, I don't remember the cost off the top of my head, but it's like reduced you know, get both reduced price for Disney Plus and Hulu. And I've never done the ESPN Plus bundle, but I am also aware that there is a new ESPN streaming offering, and I've not looked at the details of that.
Well, when you find out, let us know, because, yeah, I mean, we've gotten...
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they will email of like, oh, you could save, you know, $2 a month by including, you know, ESPN in
what,
here.
That's what they'll try and do to you. All right, next up, sad news, we lost an iconic comic book movie villain. Terrence Stamp died this week at the age of 87. Probably not a name that, you know, people under the age of, well, say 40-ish would probably know very well, although he was Chancellor Valorum in Star Wars Empire Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. So you could have seen him there. But his biggest claim to fame is probably playing General Zod in the original 1977 and or 1978 and 80 Superman 1 and Superman 2. And I mean, beyond that, he was a terrific actor. I'd seen him in a lot of stuff over the years. He was a huge deal back in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, obviously, you know, we should all live to at least 87, but yeah, this guy had a big life. And, you know, I think, Tim, you flagged on our Slack channel, you know, obviously The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, you know, he was not a stereotyped actor. He wasn't just like, he was that one thing. So, but...
This is a strange article choice. So the Chancellor Valorum is a fun call out, because when I first saw his face here in this article, I was thinking Malcolm McDowell in my head, because he kind of looks like that here. The young gentleman that they claim is him here, I'm like, I wasn't there. It could be fake news and AI for all I know. I'm sure he actually looked like that, but I definitively know he looked like General Zod. So that would have been, I think, the more iconic choice for a broader distribution.
Probably folks. So. I mean, he's terrific in those movies. He's got this kind of haughty British, you know, I'm better than you kind of attitude and voice and everything. And he's got the slick back black hair, the black beard, the black outfit. I mean, he's just the portrait of a villain. Terrific. I mean, again, one of the all-time bad guys, you know, in the sort of beginning stages of comic book movies. So yeah, he's going to go down as an all-timer. Ooh, turnabout.
Yeah. We knew that Fallout Season 2 was going to eventually come on Prime Video, but now we have a teaser trailer, which is actually pretty substantial. It's, you know, like 2.5, almost 3 minutes. And we have a debut day of December 17th. They didn't specify if they're going to do what's pretty common on Amazon, drop like 3 episodes and then go week to week thereafter. But I would expect that they love that model. We've seen it with like Boys and Invincible and stuff.
Yeah, you guys will have to do a sales pitch for me on watching season one. It's been on my to watch list for a while now. I guess maybe now it's time. Yeah. But yeah, no, I love Walt Goggins. You're
right. I mean, that's why he's suddenly everywhere. Like, yes, he did, you know, the voice in Invincible, but like, I fully believe those really, interesting Walmart commercials are 100% because he suddenly became the dude, just like J.K. Simmons is everywhere as well.
Yeah. He's got to have a high Q rating, right? People just like him. He's consistently good. I mean, anybody who's seen Justified, geez, he's incredible in that show. So
and Sons of Anarchy too. He plays an interesting role in that one too.
Yeah, I never watched that show.
He plays a trans woman.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, really interesting role. Yeah, and he's like, you know, he started out being that guy, now he's like that guy. For sure. No, he's a character and definitely a character in the show. But he's central in the before and after story in Fallout. As you see, if you watch the trailer, a lot of it's flashback stuff to him. Because he was actually the guy in the ad for the shelters.
Yeah.
And then he ended up being, I forget what they call him, a ghoul, I think it is. Basically are they should be dead, but they're not. They just keep going. Yeah, that's, and it has something to do with, you know, radiation poisoning or whatever. Yeah, cool. What else has Prime got for us, Sammy?
You know, I hemmed and hawed on this one, but then I saw that you all and heard that you all had covered, I think, the first two episodes of Alien Earth. I have not seen this week, so I'm only caught up to the first two episodes that came out for the premiere. But I said, oh, well, it's kind of on theme here, because the whole Upload series, and this is a official trailer for the fourth and final season, is all about the idea of, like, what if there was an afterlife and you could pay for it to exist in the cloud, right? You upload your consciousness up into the cloud and you know, you let a mega corporation basically loot box you the rest of your life, right? So I thought that was pretty on brand here to bring up because of the stuff that is being covered in the premise for Alien Earth, right? You've got the synths, they're fully synthetic. You have the cyborgs that are, you know, humans with enhancements. And then you've got the hybrids, which are, what if we uploaded your consciousness as a human into a synthetic body? There you go. If you're in the mood because of Alien Earth's a take on this, you might want to watch the more dramedy version of that in Upload.
I think I watched the first season, but I haven't got back to it. Did you watch it at all, or...?
Yeah, up to speed with it.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, I think of it, like I said, I've only watched the first season. I know it's been announced, but I guess I have something else to go back to. Cool.
Yeah, that's coming up August 25th. And again, I just assume it will be the same thing. Amazon drop three and then do the rest week by week. But it is a 4-part series finale event, so maybe they'll just drop all four at once. The article didn't really make it clear how it was gonna happen.
So I have this really interesting idea. Why don't we get a French guy to play a Scottish guy and a Scottish guy to play a Spaniard?
So we just go like Highlander style on this? Is that the...
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the segue for Jonathan.
Perfect segue, yes. So they're remaking Highlander, Tim.
Really? Are they going to get someone Scottish to play? Is Karen Gillan going to play the Spaniard?
No, strangely, Karen's very excited that she doesn't actually have to have a voice coach for this one. She was posting on social media today talking about how happy she is that for once she doesn't have to learn some American accent. She can just be herself. So Karen Gillan is going to be one of the stars. The main feature will be Henry Cavill, of course, our former Superman / Witcher, is going to be the star of a rebooted Highlander. I think this is one that's probably overdue for, I mean, the original is a classic, but it's kind of a B-movie too. I think the world's ready for another Highlander. It's probably been enough time.
Well, there were a couple of Highlanders, weren't there? Two or three or something?
There was at least three, and there was a TV show.
Although,
I've seen a meme going around the past few years. It circles past my nerdy social media watches, where... a dad and his son are sitting on the sofa, and they're watching, and he just finished watching Highlander, and he goes... So that son was Highlander, and he goes, that was great, Dad. Are there any more? And then the next one's a pause, and the third one is no.
Yeah.
Which anyone who's seen Highlander 2, 3, or more can appreciate. It's probably best to just walk away after one, and even one is, it's classic, but it's pretty cheese.
Yeah, but the other Highlander dude is like that other actor who was, one of the actors who's like... with Ted Cassidy, we were talking about earlier, right? Like another one of these guys who plays
Clancy Brown.
Yeah, Clancy Brown. Yeah.
Clancy Brown. He evolved now. He's, he's, again, iconic voice actor, been in a dozen different things. I mean, Shawshank Redemption and all kinds of stuff. But, but yeah, he was, I mean, him as the Kurgan in Highlander is the height of, you know, black comedy where he's, you know, he gets all his hair burned off and he goes into the church and he's just so good in that movie.
Mm-hmm. He's the bad guy.
Not as good as having Sean Connery play a Spaniard, which is the height of comedy.
With a Scottish accent, yeah.
With a thick Scottish accent and having a Frenchman play a Scottish man, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Hopefully Henry and Karen will do a better job.
The no voice coach scene... thing had me think about the Wreck-It Ralph 2 scene, the princess scene, where Merida from Brave is the only one they don't understand.
Does anyone understand what she's saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Classic.
Did they have, I wonder if they have, what's her name, play the girl in Brave in Wreck-It Ralph?
You know, I think they were, I think a lot of them were the original actresses. that did the voices.
Yeah, and they were trying to ask what's her name now, Silverman, about what kind of princess Vanellope. Are you?
Oh, Sarah Silverman. Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us once again.
Hey, just a quick circle back.
Yep.
Speaking of Alien Earth, it occurred to me. So you know how they're always trying to reincorporate, now Disney owns Star Wars, so that makes Princess Leia a Disney princess.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but the alien is an alien queen. She's a Disney queen. That's the way it is. Ooh, sorry.
Ooh, well, she's also in danger because they always kill off the moms, right?
That's true.
You know, I had not considered that. So she's not a Disney princess, but she needs to go up there with, like, you know, the queen from Snow White.
Mm. Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah. She's just there with Maleficent.
Yeah. Yep. And that the one that turns into a dragon at the end of Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah. Cool. Don't eat the apples. All right. Well, like I said, it brings us, I tried to say earlier, but it brings us to the main part of the show where we talk about something Star Trek related. And this week we're talking about Star Trek Strange New Worlds. What is Starfleet? Why am I watching this show? Is what I was thinking. But Mash did this back in the day, and it was kind of cool when Mash did the newsreel style show. And I mean, this, like, we've had this reality TV concept coming up left, right, and center. I think The Office originally started doing this too, right? Didn't it start out in the same format?
I mean, it's kind of the mockumentary, but this is more done like a documentary.
And I suppose it ties in Norteka's brother. I mean, like that, right? So anyway, yeah. So I'll try to be cheery about this episode. But anyway, so why don't we do our, what are your pitches?
All right, you go ahead, Jaime. You've been saving them up for a few weeks.
I didn't have them queued up, but, for this one, I would have it be, you know, what if we covered Starfleet from the propaganda side, you know? Mm-hmm. What if it was like...
conspiracy theory.
So I didn't really have a quip to put here, but it was... like elevator pitch style of like, what if you just saw it from like the normal person's view? This doesn't seem right. They say they're not a military. Why they got all these guns?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. They have a lot of confirmed kills for a science organization.
It's true. Well, I mean, the original series started the gun thing. But my pitch though is, speaking of guns, is sometimes you just got to shoot a horse.
Yes, indeed. I had the Enterprise crew faces its scariest challenge ever, a journalist with an agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I thought this was, I don't know, I was coming off a bit of a high. I thought the last couple episodes were really, really good. This one did feel like a bit of a step down from the past two, which I thought were exceptional. But I do think that this, exactly what Jaime raised, is a great point. You got to kind of wonder what the outside perspective is, and we don't see it very much. We see it from time to time. They touched on it, I think, really, really well in Deep Space Nine, because there was so many outside players. Mm-hmm. But how do others view the Federation and Starfleet in particular? How do they perceive them? Is it like, well, of course, that's our exploration/protection group. But, you know, when you step back from it for a second, you're not like... does the U.S. Navy also do science experiments? Like, no, not so much. They're more about the shooting things. It does seem like a strange thing to have in one sort of vessel. Like, I understand, like, Star Trek's done this for years. Oh, it's a science vessel. Like, cool. But, like, why is the one with the guns on it doing the exploring and sciencing too?
Yeah,
it's... I think they do cover some of the pragmatism. One of the things that came to mind is, okay, how many times have we seen an Enterprise go and be like, oh, we got to go save these people. Why? Because they're here in deep space. They ain't got no guns and they're in a situation that needs guns. And we thankfully have them. Right. So that's really nuanced though, versus here's the space shuttle. Look at this big ass minigun is gone. I was like, well, yeah. why is the space shuttle got minigun?
Yeah, no, it's definitely an unusual take, especially because it's from a human. It isn't, there isn't that sort of alien outsider kind of like, you know, why are you doing this, you know, others. It's from the inside, right? And, you know, as the episode obviously unfolds, we sort of realize that, you know, this line of questioning that Bethos is doing, and that, you know, he does have this agenda, and the agenda is, you know, I don't think you've done right by my sister because I don't have all the details and I haven't really talked to her about it.
She got just stabbed through the heart and stuff like that, or?
Well, that's it. Like, she basically almost died, and he's like, well, what would that have been for? Right. And so that's why he starts sort of pushing with this sort of line of questioning, who, you know, a few of them are like, hey, what? And then obviously Uhura is like, no, dude, I think you're approaching this from the wrong direction. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause yeah, she thought there was an actual interest in her in particular. Right. So,
But I will say, as a documentary style, like, it was done well. The episode was directed by Sharon Lewis, and it did have a real kind of documentary feel, that sort of like, you know, at times you're the fly on the wall, at times you're doing the interviews, you know, you're kind of trying to get all these pieces put together. Some of it's security footage, like, you kind of get, you know, like, it was well made. I don't think it was as propulsive as the last couple of weeks that were, you know, again, a couple of bangers, but it was well done.
Yeah, I think some of the things that struck me was the performances. So, ignoring like the story and everything, but like, you start out with the cast that we know, and they do not have any of the charisma that we are accustomed to, because they're, you know, official, and this is the video that's like, you know, we kind of know things aren't maybe great, and you got to be real careful. And compare that with how you see folks in the actual episode while they're in the heat of things, and then at the end when it works out nicely as best as they could for them, right? Like, you see the charisma and charm. They metaphorically and quite literally let their hair down as they, you know, learn something. So I thought that was a pretty well done by everybody, of like, you have to act like a person who is trying not to screw up on official record. And then later on, it's like, hey, you need to be as charismatic as you're accustomed to.
Well, it might be the most subdued we've ever seen Pike, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's usually pretty gregarious and he's charming. And here he's really reserved, right? You know, and except for the one spot where he's like, get the freaking camera out of my face.
Yeah. Well, there's one point where somebody whacks it, right? But Ortega, yeah, I think, right?
Yeah. I didn't quite catch exactly what she said, but she did say Akata, which would be the word for face. It was probably contextually to get this thing out of my face.
Oh, really?
Is what I assumed she said. She said it really fast, and I didn't go back to see the subtitles.
Yeah.
I also liked Mbenga's take, because he's, you know, really, you know, kind of happy and easy to deal with. And then he gets asked some real serious, like, what were you doing during these classified missions? How many people have you killed, Doctor? And he's like, I don't recall.
I lost count. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it was like, how many you killed? It was like, you know, have you ever wiped the records or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
With his paper shredder in the background, right? You know,
he's been so good consistently, Babs Olasumakun. I really like him in that role. Like, he's obviously, Dr. Mbenga was an underutilized character in the original series. So they've had a lot of room for him to flex, but he's good. And that, like you mentioned, Jaime, you mentioned the good acting. I think he was terrific in that scene where, like, his long pauses and he's looking into the camera and he's kind of trying to decide how to approach these not easy questions. I mean, you know, this is a man of medicine who we know has flat out murdered people. So I thought he played that really well. And I'm just consistently impressed with his acting.
Yeah, it's kind of a different thing when you're in the middle of a war, especially with like a race like the Klingon, where, and like what she said, Lon says at one point, you know, when he sort of asks about, you know, if a Gorn was in the room, what would you do? And she says, well, if you don't shoot first, you better run, right? Sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, it sounds like she says you should run, but she's like, you know, if you can't shoot first, run. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of like, there's no question about that in her mind, right?
This episode, it's funny, we're talking all about the documentary part and the acting and stuff like that, but this episode also slides sideways into a pretty difficult topic, which is essentially euthanasia.
Right.
You know, in this episode, this creature realizes that it has been turned from what was probably once a very beautiful creature into a very monstrous creature, and basically says to the Enterprise crew, kill me. Like, and they're like, okay.
Help me kill myself. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, I, again, obviously, you know, I think we're all, you know, fairly open-minded people, and, you know, people can make their own choices, but I'm not sure that everybody would be like, hey, sure, of course you should be able to kill yourself if you feel like you're, you know, not well or whatever, you know, like, it is a sticky subject.
The thing is that the people who didn't want the creature to kill itself were the ones who had weaponized her.
Right.
And wanted to use her in a bad way. And that's what the assumption was, that this creature was just a dumb animal, right? That had this ability, and then they could make it into a weapon. But it was through Spock and Uhura's communication with it that they learned that it does in fact have regrets, and it does realize what its role is, and it doesn't want to participate in that, right?
Yeah.
So it's not the same as wanting to kill yourself. It's sort of the same as, like, put me out of my misery, more like, you know, like, shoot the horse.
Well, and exactly as you said, it's putting down a horse, right? But it's still a bit of a, it is a sensitive subject, the idea of, like, you know, is it merciful to kill, you know, again, what if that was a humanoid being, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who had those abilities? Mm-hmm. Is it any less valid? This is an intelligent creature with feelings, right?
Well, I mean, there are societies where they do that, where they strap bombs to people's chests and say, walk into that crowd or we'll kill your family, sort of thing. Like, that happens, right? What do you do in that case? I mean, like, how do you, ideally, we all want to take, disable the bomb and help the guy out, right? But what do you do, right?
Yeah.
It's like that Mexican standoff, right?
Yeah.
I think you all are identifying some interesting things here. So clearly they set up a war situation, which could be a variety of wars over the last decade and a half. Mm-hmm. That you could say, see, it's an allegory for this. And I think you would be probably spot on, because I don't think it was any one particular one. I think it was just a recurring theme in humanity that they were using. But I do think there's an interesting choice here in that, you know, if this was a person that was under control, we have seen those, like, you know, somebody we saw the in an episode earlier where it was like, hey, is that dude really alive? You know, that like medical assistant, like, is he actually alive and being controlled by the dimensional worms, or is he, like, dead and his body's being puppeteered by the dimensional worms? But it had that question of, is it actually him that's breaking through and saying, please help me, like, I'm gonna hold it back as best I can, but, like, you need to stop me. And in a lot of movies and series would be like, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to shoot you, right? Like, I feel really bad, but, like, this is what you're asking for, and, like, I'm gonna hold them back as best I can, shoot me, you know, before I kill again. They could have made that choice. They could have made it human and changed the flavor. I also think it's very purposeful that they didn't choose, like, a weird tentacle octopus creature. They chose a beautiful butterfly kind of thing, absolutely, to make it feel kind of sadder. It's like, you know, if you strap you strap some nukes to, like, a dolphin, feels different than you strap some nukes to, like, a crab, like a giant crab, right? You just feel different about it.
It's again lots of good elements in this episode. I'm not sure that it was like a 10 out of 10, but there's a lot of stuff going on and a lot to think about in this one. The pew 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 wasn't at its highest mark, although I thought that the scene where they encounter this creature and it sort of basically fries the ship was a pretty cool effect. But it was not exactly a pew 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 episode. I guess the closest thing to conflict, I think, is probably that conversation between Uhura and Beto, right? Where she's like, basically says, you're not, you know, your sister does this because this is what she wants to do, not because she's being forced to do it. It's not like she's been indoctrinated. Although the other part that they talk about here is, you know, is exploration versus colonialism too. You know, we come to you, we give you our laws. If you want to join us, you have to follow our rules. you know, could you interpret what Starfleet does in turn, what joining the Federation means to be colonizing? I mean, they certainly do have colony planets that are following the same rules, although the history of watching Star Trek says 9 out of 10 of those are just going to go rogue anyways. But, but you know, it is also it's not an invalid theory that Beto puts forward early on, you know, is the cost of being in Starfleet, being in the Federation, equitable to being a colony, to being colonized. And, you know, there's obviously, you know, the term colonizer has become a very derogative one. Not that it, you know, shouldn't have been all along, but, you know, I mean, you know, it's a fine line between colonizer and conqueror, right? Are you there because might has made you the, you know, what's the one the Americans use, Jaime? The manifest destiny? Well, we deserve to be here.
There's definitely that. And the idea kind of more timely is, you know, hard power versus soft power.
Mm-hmm.
Deep Space Nine has covered this a bit as well, right? I think we've mentioned on this show that the scene between Quark and Garak, where they're both complaining about the Federation, where at least it's like, at least the Borg, they're in your face of like, we're going to assimilate you, you're going to be one of us. And the Federation are insidious, that they're cloying and bubbly and like, hey, it's great over here, become part of the Federation. And they're like, I don't want to, dude. That's your culture, not my culture.
Yep.
But you're still trying to absorb us just like the Borg.
Yeah, no, absolutely valid, right? I had a couple of good quotes I pulled, and they're both from Erica, where she says to her brother, it's space, it's unpredictable. That's why we don't go anywhere unarmed. Mm-hmm. Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Fair.
Yeah.
And then later on, when the creature comes at them, she says, is anyone else going to have nightmares about space dragons? Again, she gets the best lines.
I mean, you know, we've been walking around saying phasers on stun for the last 50 years, right? So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, and it's always been kind of an interesting part of Star Trek that those are the two options, you know, and obviously, you know, things like Star Wars have picked it up. There is, you know, stun settings or, you know, or I guess theoretically kill. They don't call it the kill setting. I think it's very interesting that specifically they, you know, it's set phasers to kill is what they say. It's not like set it to maximum power or, you know, set it to level 9. They specifically say kill.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little dark. A little dark.
Well, and disruptors only have one setting too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
They disrupt.
I have a big question. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't think I got the exact quote, but I think Pike says something to the effect of, to Ortega's brother, like, Have you seen somebody die before?
Yeah.
I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not a fun thing. It's not a good thing. It's just a thing that is sometimes necessary.
Yep. Speaking of death, my big question was, so in the scene where they transport the Lutani, the one Lutani that's in the ship that first attacks the thing, they beam them aboard the ship, and they're asking questions, and they're in the med bay. And when the person dies, when this alien dies in the bed, not only does it go like beep, as you is like a stereotype of like the thing, but it actually says in English in big words in the middle of it, flatlined.
Yeah.
And I was like, is it me or is it kind of messed up for the thing to just big letters say flatlined? Like, you can see the flat line. That seems unnecessarily dark.
Well, and also, like it's an alien species. Like, how would they have, like, what sort of, like, normally when you flatline, it's like they're talking about the pulse, right?
Right. So how do they know that that is the equivalent? Or I don't know. It's just, when I saw the word pop up, I was like, why would you need that? Who thought that was necessary? Where they're like, well, it's a red line and it's gone from going boop 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 to foof. Like, you'd think that that would be sufficient, but they're like, nah, you know what this needs? Big letters.
Yeah. I think to Tim's point, you know, it was even brought up by Dr. Mbenga, like, no, don't give him whatever that drug is. That's bad for their physiology. Yeah. Right. And, you know, since apparently they filmed this all in y'all's backyard, if we encounter people who know about the graphic design for these elements on the show, I would like to know, why did they decide that Flatline was necessary there, given the multi-decade, you know, medical dramas, multiple of them, that go, and it's like, okay, person's dead, like, or, you know, needs, you know, chest compressions or something, like, why did they feel like that visually needed that when you couldn't just lean on the tropes from other shows?
Yeah, it's weird. It's just weird.
Now, a word from our sponsor. Now, back to the show.
You want to move on to our next show?
Sure.
Do you want to do Foundation? Jaime, do you want to skip Alien since you haven't had a chance to see episode 3 yet? Are you up to the Foundation? Or?
Is there a way to handle it in a mostly non-spoilery so I can still enjoy? I'm not saying
absolutely
100% void spoilers, but be like, oh, okay, here's kind of the gist of what happens.
And honestly, like, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. One, I'm really curious to hear what you thought of the first two episodes anyways. So why don't we start with that? Why don't you give us your impressions of the first two episodes, and then we'll see if we can cobble together a spoiler-free rest of it.
I liked the first two episodes, but I will say it wouldn't be top tier in my list, right? Like, I think it's pretty well done. I think there's some interesting ideas here. I don't know how they're going to stitch together the hybrids, cyborg, synths sort of thing, and this fifth corporation, you know, prodigy with either a very on the nose by the writer's boy cavalier, or this is just the ego and narcissism of the character himself, who has renamed whatever his real born name was into boy cavalier just to be funsies, because he's the first trillionaire. I'm like, okay, not sure how that's all going to stitch together. But it's, it's got a lot of good, interesting vibes to me. Like, I've seen some of the things that they have hinted at or shown in other Alien properties. It's surprisingly not as focused so far on the aliens themselves, other than as a MacGuffin towards they're probably using these for military weapons. Very similar to today's, you know, episode of Strange New Worlds, of like, let's go get these things. How can we turn them into weapons? It's been a very common thing for Weyland-Yutani to do. Also, the other thing I would say is, just ignoring Netflix because they do weird releases, and ignoring Amazon, who seems like, no matter what, we are dropping 3 regardless of where it makes sense. Like, it's clearly not a hint of the quality. I'm always suspicious when a series drops more than one on the first episode. I'm like, you really need to give me that hook on the first episode. And the first episode felt more like good setting the stage, but kind of felt more like a prologue to the real story, which kind of more happens in episode 2. So I suspect that's why they dropped the first 2. They didn't drop 3. It's not like they've established a pattern on Hulu to drop 3 and then, you know, go week to week. Feels like they wanted to cover up the fact that it wouldn't have been as compelling with only one episode.
Yeah, I mean, especially because they did take kind of their sweet time in the first episode with getting to know the Wendy character, her journey, some of the backstory on the ship. Although I talked about last week's episode, it feels like there's going to be a retelling somewhere in there of what actually happened on the ship and why they ended up on a collision course with Earth. But you're right, Jaime. I think it's definitely something where they didn't time it out so that one episode could stand alone. It just never felt like that. So episode 3.
Yeah, I don't know how we can do this spoiler-free, though.
I think
just go ahead. Go ahead for it, guys. I will still watch it anyways. I don't want to hold things up. I just go, la, 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 just, la, la, just la. This. Yeah, let's just go. Just go for the spoiler. I mean, don't give me like maybe the most awesome stuff that was like, oh, whoa, blew my mind. Maybe, you know, throw me a bone and leave that out so I can still have my mind blown. But go ahead and hit the beats. Very similar to like what we just did with Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, the only thing that I would hit on this one is to say, you know, so the third episode kind of wraps up the story of what's happening in New Siam, where the ship has crashed. They're there to get the aliens. So it does wrap up that part of the story, and then it kind of sets a new chapter, which is back in Neverland, which is Boy Cavalier's island headquarters. And it does play out really nicely. Some good action, some good stuff. Although at one point, the alien like kidnaps someone to use them as bait. That felt a little too far for me.
Well, and also the yeah, using them as well. I mean, the aliens have always sort of had that, you know, they build them into the walls, and then they use them to gestate, you know, new aliens or new xenomorphs, right? Like that's what you see in the second Alien movie, and you see that in further ones, right? Because isn't there a scene where Ripley takes the blowtorch to the that's in the second one, right? To put them out to begin to shoot the horses, right? But it was weird because I mean there's also and then they're cornered like the two characters are cornered and because one's a synth the xenomorph stopped the attack, right? That was kind of weird the way it had them where it wanted them. And yeah, it goes back and kind of toys with them a bit, or I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
That was to give us the reveal about the alien, the blood being acid, because they hadn't really covered that at all in this version of the show yet. Right? Every single Alien movie, they have the model glue poured on the styrofoam effect that makes it look like it's burning with acid, right? So
that
trope.
Well, let me ask you a question based on what you just described.
It's early in the episode too, by the way.
So the one thing that they did show in, I want to say it was episode 2, when the alien is like caught in a net, it's like been zapped, electrocuted by the cyborg guy from the ship. And, you know, the guards come and he's like, yeah, you all need to not show any fear. They can smell or sense fear. Forget the words he says. And they are afraid and they get ripped to shreds. And he is purposefully trying to like meditate or eliminate all fear. And it kind of looks at him and then says, oh, wait, there's more fear over there. And it goes and shreds some guys up.
Yeah. Right?
That seems like it would lend credence to the idea of like it might look at sense and be like, I don't know, man. That's like a Roomba. I don't care. That's not something.
No body temperature. Well, it's like the Predator. We used infrared to look for warm bodies, right?
Yeah.
And since I may not have the same, 37.6 degrees Celsius. Sorry, Jaime.
Yeah.
96 degrees and, Fahrenheit, I think, right?
And because I'm going to 37 Celsius, right? 98.6 Fahrenheit. Because I don't really have much reason to bring up this movie. This is very similar conceptually to the Smith and Smith movie After Earth, where the whole premise was.
And that's don't why show you're fear, here, Jaime.
Fear so is the mind killer.
Smith and Smith After Earth?
Yeah, it was Jaden Smith and Will Smith. It was like the vehicle
not
movie.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Okay.
No, not Mr. and Mrs. Smith. The other Smiths, their real names are Smith. Afraid, not show your fear, because that's how the alien creatures would prey on you.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like the concept of this show, and so far I'm happy with the execution. Although, I think we talked about it last week, Tim. Like, the basic premise of this is, what if we took a bunch of children, put them in Iron Man suits, and had them fight an alien? That's, like, it continues this week, too, where you're just like, it's starting to tiptoe a little bit towards the whole superhero kind of, what if we have these like superpowered humanoid people and they can fight that, like, I don't know. I saw Predator versus Aliens. It was fine. Like, the whole sales pitch of this show is aliens on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's how stupid can the corporations be that they bring the, I mean, that's always been the trope, like right from again, Alien 2, where the Paul Reiser character wants to he's like, wearing the 80s, pink shirt with the collar up, all that stuff.
I mean, he was 100% concerned about blowing up the facility because he's like, do you know how much money that costs? Like, we're going to lose the corporation a lot of money.
Yeah, that's true. But in this case here, it's sort of the security officer, who's the guy, the meditating guy you talked about last week, who's an augmented human, right? Mm-hmm. He's going around the ship looking for, soldiers and stuff, and comes across two of the kids two male characters, right, who are clearly acting younger than their visual age, right? And he spots that right away. He's like, you guys are like kids, right? And then there's the whole grooming thing too. Did you get that, John? Did that not creep you out?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, just sort of like he realizes these guys are young and that kind of thing. It was interesting too, when he calls his boss and his boss was a woman, and now he speaks to the same person or the same Mrs. whatever her name is. Right. But it's not, it's the granddaughter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of, and she says, I'm like, you're expecting my grandmother, she's long dead. Right. So, and I run the show. Right. So, and then, you know, of course they've got the specimens and they bring them back to Neverland, like you mentioned. Right. Nothing really goes badly wrong there, but there are some like dude stuff. Like there are a few Lucy in the Chocolate Factory kind of moments for me, like where they're like, you're going to do what with the eggs? You know, like, are you nuts? You know?
Yeah.
But of course, I think since they're synths, maybe they were safe in doing that because it wasn't, because that's, he says at one point to the, spoilers for you, Jaime, but he says at one point to the, is it Kid Cavalier? What's his name again?
Boy Cavalier.
He says to him at one point, you know, like he's like, well, I mean, into the lab. He's like, listen, these things look for human beings, of which you are one.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep this door closed, right? This is Timmy the Oliphant talking, right? And there's a whole, you know, typical dissection of the xenomorph, you know, I don't know what state, the middle state or second state or whatever, right?
Well, yeah, it's funny because we've, for years, obviously, we've been part of this franchise now for, 40 plus years. Mm-hmm. We've seen how the eggs work. We've seen how the alien works. They've sort of showed us lots of stuff. This is the first time that somebody like dissects one of these things to kind of figure out how it works.
One, yeah, because Ash in the first movie pokes around at a dead one, right?
So, and a dead one, right? Yeah.
And it turns out that there's like this little creature inside, which is like, I guess the little,
it's like an embryo almost,
well,
like,
yeah, like a tadpole sort of deal, right?
Yeah.
And then they stick it on a piece of meat. So the thing about it is for those of you who don't know the Alien franchise, is if the xenomorph attacks a human or attaches to a human, the offspring is human-like.
Yeah.
Right? Two arms, two legs, and a xenomorph head. If it attacks a dog, then it has four legs, right? Sort of thing, right? So
yeah, Alien 3 had that dog-like one.
Yeah, because one of the movies had a dog-like one, right?
Yep. Was it episode 2, Jaime? Is that the one with the cat has the eyeball creature in it? And that is a scene and a half, man.
Yeah, I don't know if they covered in episode 3, but like, it is unclear to me, is the ship that was bringing all those specimens, were they bringing them from like a variety of planets, or is this planet like Space Australia where everything tries to kill you, even the plants and stuff? It's like,
no, I think they kind of sort of, he says at one point that, you know, we've brought these specimens from it. I don't remember the exact quote, but he did sort of say they come from multiple worlds.
Okay, so not Space Australia then, like they specifically found alien life forms in various worlds.
But I mean, that was the whole directive for, and that's why Ash went bananas, was in the first movie, is that the directive from Mother, which was transmitting what was sent from Earth, was at no, the crew's expendable.
The crew's expendable, and that's clearly what the message that they sent to the Moro, right? The security officer. Because we see people like banging on the door going like, please don't do this to us. You know, like it's pretty good. I feel the same way about an alien TV show that I have about some of these other, you know, where we've taken Star Wars and explored it here. I like that they are giving us time to really kind of immerse in the mythology of Alien and aliens. I just wish I cared more about the characters, because even like, I really like the main character, Wendy Sydney Chandler, I think is really great. I love Alex Lawther, who's playing Hermit, the medic. And I like some of the supporting actors as well. But like, I'm having a tough time caring at all about these Lost Boys. They're all just like, well, I should be the one who's the favorite, and I act like I don't like them. I'm like, it's when the alien kills them all eventually, which of course the alien's going to do. I'm like, that's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
Just as long as I leave Timothy Oliphant alone.
There's no way. There's no way Oliphant makes it out of this show. There's no chance.
Yeah, he's going to be on a table with a
he's going to be spitting head. White goo before the end of this series, mark my words.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't like Curly, the one that's trying to worm her way into to be the favorite?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. And I think I'm with Jaime. Like, one, the pretense of, like, his name is Boy Cavalier is like, oof. And then just to have him be this, like, you know, just very flamboyant, kind of like self-satisfied, you know, I'm so smart. I have to create something that's as smart as me just to have a conversation. It's just like, well, it's going to be fun to watch an alien pop its mouth through your head.
Yeah, I think what you need to understand here about Boy Cavalier is, what if you took, just pick them, like a Jake Paul, a Logan Paul, or a Mr. Beast and said, what if you scaled them up to trillionaire? What would happen to society? And this is exactly, you would have Boy Cavalier as the ultimate sort of that kind of dude thing. That's how I interpret that.
I mean, he is a hyper-realized version of creators of Facebook or
Silicon Valley Boy.
Any name insert at Silicon Valley pretty boy, you know, billionaire nerd here, you know, Bezos, any of them. Like, these are the people who are like, you know what, I'm so good I can make a rocket that looks like a penis. It's all he's just a massive gaping ego, right? Like, he's just this you know, unchecked ego. Who is obviously, you know, they say he's the youngest trillionaire in history. He controls 1/5 of the earth. So, you know, like, okay, cool. I'm enjoying the show so far. I like the way that it's made. I like the way that it's shot. I thought that I really enjoyed the second episode where they were like in the building and there's sort of this like, where's the alien? It's part the spaceship. It's part apartment complex. Like, that's kind of what I wanted from a show where the alien comes to Earth. And then it felt like they kind of got away from that in this third episode. So I'm hoping that we see a little bit more, like, right now, essentially, you know, they bring back all the creatures to Neverland in the third episode. So clearly the battleground is more likely to be there going forward, which is less interesting to me. I think the idea of, like, alien on the loose on a weekend in New York, shore leave, is way more interesting to me.
Yeah, it's more like Jurassic Park in that sense. Like, it's kind of an island in the middle of nowhere. Like, who cares, right?
Yeah. Well, and bloodbath, right?
One thing I do like about this show, though, is the sort of the late 70s aesthetic and the music, the way they sort of play the music, the same way the original couple of movies played. The surfacing of, like, the environments and stuff like that, even the couches are very sort of the time. And in fact, one of my biggest complaints about the first movie is when Dallas and I think Ash are dissecting the alien, or they're trying to get the alien off of Ian, not what's his name's face.
Yeah,
trying to get it off of his face. And they're wearing like surgical masks, but they're wearing like an oxygen mask with no hose attached to it.
Hey, it was like 1978. What do you want?
And they're wearing hockey gloves. The alien spaceship or hockey gloves actually. But in this episode, what's the name of the guy you like, the Lothar guy?
Oh, Alex Lothar, yeah. Hermit.
Hermit's lying on the table, and he's got a mask on, and it's the same mask from the first movie, but it's got a hose connected this time, because it is really a breathing tube. It's a mask you wear in a hospital when you're being fed oxygen, right? But
Yeah,
and there's the creepy little experiment they do with part of his body, right? You know? That's not going to turn out well.
We'll leave some things for Jaime to discover.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
But yeah, no. Again, good episode. Not a great one. The first half is definitely a lot more propulsive than the second half. But
it wasn't so much pew pew in this one, other than the first fight with the xenomorph, right? So
yeah,
you know, and the and the creepy security guard groomer guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two actors are playing the Lost Boys, playing as if they're like 12 and 11 are great.
I mean, they do play the sort of quirky children well. It's just, it becomes a little cloying after a while. You're just like, shut up, grow up. What's wrong with you two?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a few years for them to grow up, right?
Yeah.
Go into their bodies.
Jaime, are you watching Foundation? Have you caught up on Foundation?
Oh, no. We have just started Foundation. We're like an episode or two in. So
you all
talk as it's perfectly meaningless to me. I will inevitably forget.
What we said right now, it would not matter because so much has changed from season one. Like, it's literally like 300 years later. It's so, show is just so expansive.
Yeah, I figured the worst spoilers would be, oh, I guess so-and-so must survive because how else would they have created children, you know, or at least they got to get their funsies before they died, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, guys, carry on.
So this is, Foundation. This is season 3, episode 6, The Shape of Time. And we start the episode where we left at last time with the Gale.
Demerzel and Gale
have now met. And Demerzel kind of just forces her way to, like, at one point has Gale held up, you know, 6 feet off the ground by her throat.
Very Darth Vader.
Yeah, sort of like, you know, why shouldn't I kill you sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And pointing out that, you know, I realize you're pulling all the strings here, right? So, and why should I let you continue to pull the strings, right? They don't talk about Dawn, though, or
she mentions it very briefly. She said Dawn's life signals have ended. Well,
he's floating head over tail out in space, right? So.
Yeah, no, I mean, we kind of knew how he ended up in the last episode, but I mean, this was an interesting one, and it really does kind of come to a head, right? Like, that part was interesting because this is the first time since, like, I think where Jaime is, where these two characters have been back in the same space, having conversations and stuff like that. But the idea that they finally go back to New Terminus, they use Magnifico to try and, like, get everybody on the same page. They're all on the same page. They go down to see this vault. It opens up, and then they're like, oh, yeah, you know how you're the guy who knows everything? What do you mean you don't know everything? And then all hell breaks loose. And, yeah, it definitely kind of, it's a good twist. Last episode had that, you know, sort of good one, too, of like, oh, you were wrong. And there goes, you know, all the warships and stuff. But this one, essentially sets the stage for where we know this is going to go, which is to a battle on Trantor, right? So, but yeah, I mean, it was a weird episode. It was a little bit weirdly paced, but
About Lee Pace, though, he does have his comeuppance in a sense that he finally finds his betrothed or his girlfriend or whatever, and then learns the harsh truth that she was just playing him, right?
Well, she basically says, like, if I was with you, it wasn't why you thought and whatever. And yeah, I mean, it's just so, I mean,
my life mate, you know, like,
I'm loving Lee Pace this season. I mean, he was good the first two seasons, particularly good in second season, but here the, like, hippie bearded long haired, he's so good. He's like, I brought candy. Like, oh, it's so good. I'm absolutely loving him this season. So that's a lot of fun. I mean, this episode is kind of, it starts out being a lot of glue. It's Demerzel and Gale having, you know, a big download of information about the mule and, you know, what does this mean for Empire and what does this mean for Foundation and everything else. And then, like I said, it just kind of goes off the rails at the end. I'm really looking forward to see where we pick up, this week's episode because, I mean, the title of this week's episode that is dropping tomorrow is Foundation's End. So, it'll be interesting to see where this takes us. And, of course, now we're past the halfway mark in the 10-episode season. So, interesting to see where they go with this. I'm curious to see what the plan is for this show. Where do they see this going? I mean, they're not slowing down. I mean, this is Jane Espenson and David Goyer. This is two, like, big, powerful, smart, good science fiction showrunners and writers and producers working on this show. It's got a lot of talent on it. They don't seem like they're backing down, and Apple obviously has infinite pockets. They could continue to do this show, but I just, every season when they start getting all this stuff going, I'm like, are they going to get a fourth season, a fifth season? Do they have a long game? Do they have an end game? Like, where is this going? Especially because you, like, obviously you know better than anyone, but like the source material is not endless, but damn.
It's like you're talking like, well, I showed you the books last week, right? It was like in the follow-up, it was, there's gotta be, I mean, I've read, I don't know, maybe a dozen books on this subject, right? On this, around this environment, this earth or whatever, this world, right? So yeah, I'm looking at like, there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 foundation books. There's 3 robot books. There's 3 planet books. And then there's a whole pile of other ones that go with, right? So, you know, like this, like we're probably in the second of the foundation books because, I don't know, maybe, yeah, we know we're in second foundation already, which is the third book, right? But the mule was in the second book, I'm pretty sure. But, and that, the dude that's like the transport guy, I always forget his name, the two kids that are the married couple, the ones, what's his name that they're descended from?
Oh, Mallow, right?
Holber Mallow,
yeah.
Yeah, so in this, like I said, I think in the second book I talked about how, you know, the first book is about like the whole concept of psychohistory. I keep saying prehistory, but it's actually psychohistory. That Harry Seldon comes up with. And basically it's a mathematical construct that says, you know, this is what's going to happen in the future sort of thing, right? And all the pieces do fall into place. And there's a few sort of, you know, thing, like I think the lot in a couple of episodes ago when Harry comes back and they confront him and say, well, this is not what's happening. He kind of just turns back into a zaps himself back into out of existence and just walking, like leaves the room kind of thing.
Yeah. Back away that, slowly. Right? It does the Homer walking into the hedge. Yeah.
Well, cause he knows. Yeah. Cause he knows that like the whole idea behind psychohistory is that it doesn't matter what the people around the society do, you know, at some point in time, they will catch up with the theory. Right.
Yeah.
And the mule is an outlier. The mule's kind of like, it wasn't, the mule's not in the calculation, right? But the mule actually does have an effect, right? But anyway, so the what's interesting about this, I think there's the prelude, the foundation, there's one, I'm trying to remember the name of the book. I was talking to my friend about that the other day. His name is Adam, by the way. That, because I was just checking my memory with his, and there's I think it might be Foundation Edge or Foundation on Earth or something like that, where they lose Trantor in history. Right. Like they don't even know where this mythical, you know, it's like the Garden of Eden kind of thing. Right. It's sort of told off in Yore. And so they go and try and find it because they want to go to the Great Galactic Library where, you know, all the information was once stored. And then they discover that, in fact, Foundation or Trantor wasn't actually the origin spot of all of the foundation and all the stuff that happens, but there was this mythical place called Earth.
Oh,
yeah. That place. Yeah. So all these people come from Earth at some point. Right. So
yeah.
Yeah. Whether and they become spacefaring kind of thing. And some like in Robots of Dawn, they're on a planet called Aurora where the people are, they're sort of like the upper class, super like the rich neighborhood of the universe kind of thing. But those people have never been to Earth sort of thing, right? Even though they know of Earth, but like people left Earth and they formed these different planets and stuff. But I mean, so it's in terms of like, and apparently Asimov, like Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke had mapped out this, or Tolkien even had mapped out this entire, you know, structure of what he thought it was going to be. Right. So, I mean, he did write books obviously to make them fit the formula, but I mean, because, you know, I think you're pretty sure you understand that psychohistory isn't a real thing, right?
What?
Yeah.
I am so invested.
I know, eh? But,
next you'll tell me that phrenology is not real either.
So in terms of where this show could go, right? There's a lot of places it can go. In fact, I could see this spinning out for years. Like, you know, like the House of, what's the, not the House of Dragon, what's the one?
Well, Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, yeah. So Game of Thrones is made up of a number of books, right? Am I not correct? Or, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's the core books, but it's also now it's I mean, essentially House of the Dragon is based on like a history book, more or less.
Yeah. So, and there's supposedly, the Game of Thrones book that, or the Game of Thrones ending ended before the books even finished being written, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So pitter patter, George, get on it. But in the same sense, like this, like, and again, some of these, like, I mean, the Foundation books were written in the '50s. The ones I'm talking about, I read in the '90s, you know, and they were new in the '90s kind of thing. Right. So took him, he spent like 40 years sort of working out this whole thing. Right. So yeah, in terms of like where this show can go here, and then they could spin, you know, it can spin out or they can break out. There are lots of stories to be told.
Well, and it's so dense. There's so much, like they could obviously go a lot of different directions. They could do a lot of different things to try and, you know, they don't have to follow one linear path. They can bring in all the elements from different shows and different books and whatever, and tie them all together. But again, I can't imagine this show is cheap. It looks like they spend all the monies on the, you know, the special effects and everything, and the designs and the sets and like
and the practical show effects. Yeah. The practical locations and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're not shooting green screens here. Yeah.
New. So yeah, well, Jaime, you've got all that to look forward to. Take your time, there's no rush.
So Tim, it would probably be like 7 mainline books. Like, I know they can move stuff around, they can smoosh in things from like others, like they don't have to do like 20 books. It sounds like roughly 7 books worth, so 7 or 8 seasons if you were to project where they would go.
Well, I mean, like one of the books that I'm talking about is called Prelude to the Foundation. So he's the OG of taking a story and then going back to the origin of it and moving forward towards it, right? So, because there's the sort of, I think the Prelude to the Foundation is kind of like the Harry Seldon, you know, origin story kind of thing, right? It's been a long time since I read it, but yeah. And that was the first time I kind of dealt with the prequel problem, right? You know? Because I remember reading that thinking, well, I know where this is going, so...
But it does give, like, a reasonable, definitive end insight. So Jonathan's asking the question, is this going to end up like Amazon's Wheel of Time? Which they got 3 seasons and then said, you know what, it's too expensive, we're not getting the numbers they want. I think where this is different is in a few different ways. One, Wheel of Time is, like, literally 19 to 20 books, something like that.
Robert Jordan just kept writing, and he literally died without finishing it, too.
And I've heard that they get kind of bloated, you know, I don't know where, but like towards the later part. So even if you squish that down to like 10 books, right? It's like, well, that's 10 seasons. Are you going to go a 10 season at that expense? Really difficult. And I just assume the pew, pew, pews get even more powerful in the like final season, right? So that's a hard one. But Apple has a smaller amount to deal with. And this seems to be, like, they always lead off with Foundation and their, like, WWDC keynotes and other things. Like, it's pretty much their, like, you know, get an Oscar kind of thing. Like, they're literally not available for that. But you get my point, right? Like, this is the one that you do for the prestige. And we can spend money. We have infinite money because we're Apple. And so they can just believe in it and then sign up for it for, like, 7, 8 seasons. Whereas Amazon was like, hey, we want to create our own Game of Thrones kind of thing. And if it ain't working out, we're just going to kill that business line.
Yeah, well, let's back up a bit, too, in terms of like the number of books or whatever. But because, I mean, originally Foundation was a trilogy, like Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a trilogy. Not, you know what I mean? Like
a trilogy in 5 parts, I believe, is the joke.
Yeah. So the Foundation is generally thought of as the 3 books, Foundation, Foundation Empire, and Foundation, and Second Foundation. Those were the 3 books that he wrote, you know, in the 1950s, right? So this show could be that trilogy, right? And like I said, the mule is in the middle of the trilogy. So, you know, once they figure out the mule, maybe they have another season left in them to do, and then they've kind of done the trilogy, right? Like that would work.
I mean,
you know, 5 seasons maybe.
I think if they needed to, you know, again, obviously making a show isn't cheap. And one of the most unpredictable expenses is the cast, because you sign them generally to a certain deal that basically has options that you can pick up and pick up and pick up. But famously, that's why, you know, Star Trek used to end at 7 seasons for the three, you know, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager, was because after that, they had to renegotiate the contracts and they were like, we can't afford to do that. So it becomes cost prohibitive. Here, it would be the same thing. But if, as you say, if they want to tell different parts of it, they could basically wrap up this main story and then do a side story and another side story and another side story like they did with Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah, and I mean, they've kind of created their own problem here by having this, you know, the Cleons, instead of Cleons being just, you know, another emperor in descended from the previous, the problem they've made for themselves is the same three actors playing the three Cleon stages, right?
Yeah.
I mean, then they run into what happens if Dumbledore dies in real life, you know?
Yeah.
So that, as they had that problem, because that was the same thing. They had Dumbledore in all seven books of the Harry Potter franchise, and the actors didn't last long enough to make the whole thing, right? So.
Yeah.
We got that deep fake tech, though, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they could have done. Well, ideally, maybe they should have started with a couple of, you know, actors, maybe as voice actors, and just done, like, CG emperors, right?
Well, I mean, it's to the point where it's like, you don't even need like a, again, I am not supporting this. I'm just cynical of what will happen. It's like, hey, you know, equivalent of Richard Gamble died. It's like, all right, hey, you, electrician's grip. Yeah. You want to be in this movie? Yeah.
Stand here and say
here. Go stand here. Well, what do I say? It's like, literally doesn't matter. Just stand there. We just need you in frame.
Yeah.
We'll fix it all in post.
Yeah, that's what they told David Prowse.
Have you ever heard the David Prowse versions? Yeah. Where they,
yes.
Good call on the James Earl Jones. Good call.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that was a good call. Yeah. Cool. All right. So we move on to the watch list.
Yes.
So I got a call from one of our relatives the other day who's a huge fan of Back to the Future, who said, hey, I have a ticket to see Back to the Future and it's gone a wanton, so do you want to go see Back to the Future with me? So I'm not a huge, not a huge theater person. I mean, I am a huge theater person, don't get me wrong, but I haven't spent a lot of time at theater. And so this was the Back to the Future musical, which I kind of thought, I think it came out in 20, it was announced in 2019, it came out in 2020. There was some big, you know, world-changing event that kind of put a stop to it. It did premiere in 2021 when the world came back in London, and it's pretty cool as plays go. I think it's finishing here in Toronto. I think this is the final weeks of it here in Toronto. But I mean, how do you make a DeLorean spin into the like a life-size DeLorean spin onto the stage, you know, and, you know, not quite knock Marty off when Doc appears, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do they make it fly at the end of the movie? Ask yourself these questions. How do they make it go 88 miles an hour and then and make it disappear? Like, they do this live on stage. It's pretty amazing. I didn't think about it at the time, but when I went back and watched some of the how-to stuff, they literally make this car appear and disappear. And then they sing.
Sure. I mean, you know,
so they work the power of love and what's the other one, the one in the credits?
Oh, Back in Time. Yeah.
Back in Time. They do the Back in Time after the curtain call. Right. So,
yeah.
And the kid who plays Marty, it looked like he was actually playing the guitar.
Hmm.
Right. They do the whole school dance thing. The character that plays the Crispin Glover character, George McFly, he's really good. I mean, like he's got that, he's got the mannerisms down and stuff like that. And the guy who plays, the kid who plays, and they're using skateboards on the stage and there's like moving set pieces, you know, it's pretty cool the way they do this. And they do a lot of like, you know, Doc's, or workshop will kind of close in near the front of the stage while they do things in the back. And then, you know, they have the clock tower, they reproduce the whole clock tower scene. Pretty cool way to do it. I think the video I have here is sort of the making of, or maybe the trailer for it. But yeah, it was a really entertaining piece. And I know, Jonathan, you're a big fan of Back to the Future franchise, right?
Yes, so, I am. Yep.
And it basically is the movie. They didn't really. I mean, they, for the sake of singing and stuff like that, they do that. There's a few things like, you know, there's no car full of horse manure scene, but you know, they kind of go through the whole thing with, and the guy who plays Biff is totally unlikable. You know, so yeah, it was really good experience. So if you have a chance to see Back to the Future musical, I definitely say take it. It's a good thing.
They wisely, like from what I see in the video here, they wisely spent good money on the DeLorean prop versus like pulling out the cardboard cutout, you know, equivalent you might see in a musical. Like, they definitely spent money on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, it's a fiberglass DeLorean. Actually, there's one cool thing that I'll post a couple of videos that I found maybe since I posted this one, but at one point they take the flux capacitor out of the car and show it to the audience because you can't see inside the car, right? So they have the flux capacitor in a box and they just take it out and they show it to the audience and put it back in as they're telling the story about how the thing works. And I think the people that steal the plutonium, or Doc steals the plutonium from, they're not
the Libyans.
The Libyans. Yeah. Yep. They're not in it, but they have another way for Doc to run into trouble. But, so it's definitely worth going to see if you get a chance. Right.
Cool.
This other one is kind of a rumor. I was as a Reddit group I follow on Vision Pro, and somebody posted today. It looked like in a Chinese app store that the movie F1 is now available. So it's not available quite yet here. I looked earlier today, but I'm going to say that F1 is going to be available to be viewed in your home environment or on your Vision Pro if you have one. Smoke if you got them. F1, yeah, with Brad Pitt. It's a really good movie. Turn it up. Turn it up loud. And that's it for me. And we'll go over to Jaime and see what he's up to.
Yeah, I had led into this earlier when talking with Jonathan about this, but I do recommend watching Squid Game Season 3 on Netflix, but specifically you should watch it back-to-back with Season 2 if you haven't seen Season 2, because as I sort of suspected and now confirmed, I don't know the history. I haven't looked up to see what happened here, but it's worth noting that for, you know, I'm going to say going forward, Netflix releases, like we've seen this with Wednesday, it's like Season 2, Part 1, and then a Part 2 is going to come later. It's like an interesting way for Netflix to stay with shows relevant and yet still mostly drop all of the episodes at once, right? They drop all of Part 1 at once, and then a month or two later, drop all of Part 2, and then maybe a Part 3. I don't know what happened with Squid Game, but I kind of suspect it was caught in the transition between, you know, hey, we're Netflix, we just drop all the episodes of a season at once, and the new model. So this really feels like it should have been, and maybe some enterprising fan out there will create a director's cut where you just smush Season 2 and Season 3 together. It would be an amazing season. When you stretch it out to cover like 8 and 6 episodes, I think it's like 14 episodes total between the two seasons of Season 2 and 3, it diminishes the brand, in my opinion. It feels like, I feel like there was accounting tricks or something that happened here. This really should not have been two seasons for 2 and 3. It should have been one season solid, all killer, no filler, 10 episodes. But I still recommend it if you enjoyed Season 1. If you didn't like Season 1, you're not going to like 2 and 3.
Oh, really? Okay.
I'm not going to go too far into it. I'm just going to say, so Peacemaker Season 2 is theoretically coming out tonight. I checked back in with the good folks here at Crave, who are responsible for distributing here in Canada. It's HBO Max in the States. And it still hadn't dropped as of, 10 o'clock my time, so 9 o'clock Eastern time. It still hadn't shown up on the stream. Hopefully it'll be out there by now. But so I don't think we'll be doing it, and as timely a fashion. But that being said, I decided that since it had been three years since the last and first season of Peacemaker, I'm going to go back and rewatch it because I remember really enjoying it. I remembered lots of the details, but you know, it's been enough time that I thought I should probably brush up because I remember really liking it. So I sat down this week and rewatched all 8 of the season 1 episodes again and was very much reminded why I like this show. It's just so far unhinged that it is just, it's so much fun. It's so just silly and crass and just over the top in all the best ways. John Cena is so good. There's just so much stupidity and hilarity that I must say I really, really enjoyed my Season 1 rewatch, and it definitely fired me up for Season 2. So I'm looking forward to sitting down to watch Season 2 probably as soon as we're done here.
Yeah, I did see, I don't know exactly what time the episode came out here on HBO Max of the US. It seemed like it was somewhere around 6 or 6:30 because right before we were about to record this podcast, I saw a notification from HBO Max saying new episode of Peacemaker available.
Oh, nice.
So I could see it here, and hey, look at that. They only released one episode, so good sign. The Ties That Grind, 45 minutes. And the premise is, hoping to find a place among them, Peacemaker interviews for a spot in the Justice Gang, while Harcourt struggles to find work on the heels of Adebayo's bombshell press conference. Economos is forced to surveil Peacemaker. So there you go. That's what you have to look forward to.
Nice.
And I will also watch it as well.
I'm in.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jonathan, if you want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
Oh, I'd start with Blue Sky on Instagram. I'm at JPK News, or you can check out youtube.com/@JPK.
All right. And Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Instagram as @DevOfTheHair.
All right. My name is Timitra, DimMitra, and I can be found on the Mastodon, on the Blue Sky, pretty much. That's where I handle most places. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. If you have feedback or questions, you can get in touch with us on the website. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.